Thank you very much for the introduction, and also thank you to the organizers for this great event and for giving me the opportunity to tell you something this afternoon about some recent work of mine related to this area. The overall theme of this talk is going to be trying to find results about the global symmetries of a specific class of quantum field theories, and namely those that are realized in the framework of string theory. Now, I think, of course, I don't have to motivate the importance of global symmetries and generalized global symmetries to this particular audience. So one might ask, what about the second part of the title, the string theory part? And I think that it's also extremely useful to consider, given that we know that one of the consequences of string theory is the existence of many non-trivial classes of quantum field theories in various dimensions, including models that would be, I think, extremely hard to study using other techniques. So what I believe is that we can actually learn a lot if we combine a field theory point of view with this more string theoretic perspective. And for instance, one of the important goals, I think, that we should keep in the back of our minds is that combining these two approaches, we might be able to enlarge the scope of controlled examples of quantum field theories with interesting global symmetries so that, for instance, we can try and learn important lessons about what the dynamical implications, for instance, of generalized global symmetries might be. Just like a brief reminder, I don't have to spend a lot of time on this point, namely that you can get QFTs from string theory, given that Iñaki has done a great work in sort of introducing the idea in his talk. And just as a very brief reminder, we know that string theory or M theory is, of course, a theory of gravity, but one of its most striking predictions is actually the fact that it can make statements about non-gravitational theories, so quantum field theories. And while the particular details, of course, depend on the construction you might want to consider, as a rule of thumb, the quantum field theory is going to be realized by some localized degrees of freedom. They might be localized, on, say, on a word volume of a brain, these solitonic objects that Iñaki has already introduced, or it might be a singularity in the geometry. And at least, sort of roughly speaking, one the general mechanism is that if we consider the low energy dynamics, the higher dimensional gravity decouples, and we are indeed left with a non-gravitational quantum field theory. And what's particularly relevant about this circle of ideas is that in this way we can access quantum field theories that are unusual from a more textbook approach. For instance, they are intrinsically strongly coupled and don't really often admit a conventional Lagrangian description. And in my mind, one of the most striking predictions of string theory is in particular the existence of higher dimensional fixed points in 5D and in 6D. There, it was known for a long time that the, say, the superconformal algebra exists, but what's really hard to establish using purely field theoretic techniques is whether there exist interacting theories that can realize those algebras. And string theory can do that for us. And another very interesting application of these ideas is that once we have these non-trivial higher dimensional fixed points, we can go to lower dimensions. And that gives us a vast, vast class of theories, some of which admit a conventional Lagrangian, some of which don't. And an example I would like to for you to remind you, because it's going to appear later, is it's a very standard and very well-studied situation, namely going from 6D to 4D on a Riemann surface. This is the class S program and all its various generalizations, which are very useful in that they give us really, they enlarge for us the scope of possible 4D theories in very interesting and non-trivial ways. And one point that I believe it's worth emphasizing is that when we're playing this game, it's really topology and geometry that are extremely important. In that, I mean, if we want to define a QFT using a string construction with either brains or a singularity, the input data is going to be first of all, something topological and geometrical about the string setup that we want to consider. And I think we can think of this as a non-perturbative approach that I believe can complement in very useful ways other approaches based, for instance, on fields and Lagrangians that we have seen in many talks at this conference. And another point that I find striking is that this more topological and geometric point of view, that it's natural in string theory, seems to be very well suited with this other idea that topology and geometry should really be the way of thinking about global symmetries in QFT. Indeed, the modern point of view on global symmetries is that they are, in a sense, a topological subsector of the theory we would like to study. So given this happy coincidence, if you wish, between the stringy point of view and the modern point of view on global symmetries, I think we are faced with a central question that I believe can motivate interesting investigations. And namely, if we're given a quantum field theory realized in string theory, can we determine its generalized global symmetries and their anomalies directly from the topological and geometric data that defines our string theory construction, without going to maybe an indirect route in which, say, we first identify maybe another description of the same QFT and we use that to determine its global symmetries and anomalies. And this is, in a sense, still an open question. There has been, of course, a lot of work, and the details depend on the specific setup we want to consider. But I would like to tell you that I believe there is a general strategy that we can apply successfully in a variety of non-trivial situations. And it's based, again, on this observation that our quantum field theory that we want to study is localized inside a bigger ambient space. So I'm going to use little d for the dimension of the space-time dimension of our QFT, and big D for the ambient space. So at least at a very schematic level, our total space-time will look like this. We have the word volume of our external space-time. That's where the QFT we want to study lives. And then there are some internal directions. And as we have seen in Iñaki's talk, at least in a first approximation, it's useful to organize these internal directions in terms of something like an overall radial coordinate, which is literally an overall radial coordinate if you have a cone, as it was in Iñaki's talk, and some compact space that I'm calling L, which encodes for us the angular directions that surround the locus where the QFT lives. So given that these features are quite general, they suggest an equally general strategy. Namely, we know that we should consider a low energy situation because that's where our QFT emerges from the full string theory. And we also know that in that regime, we can use a supergravity theory to describe the full string theory or M theory. And therefore, what this picture suggests is that we should be able to consider what happens when we take this higher dimensional supergravity theory, let it be 10 or 11 dimensional, and put it on this compact space L. Then we're left with a lower dimensional theory. It lives in particular in D plus one dimension, so it's one dimension higher than the QFT that we want to study. And that, of course, probably is ringing a bell. We know that there is a very efficient way of encoding global symmetries and anomalies of a D-dimensional field theory, and namely, that's its symmetry field theory, which precisely lives in one dimension higher. So, given that we have these ingredients, there is a natural identification that we can try and make precise and computable. Namely, can we think of this D plus one dimensional supergravity on this compact space as giving us, through its topological couplings, the symmetry field theory of the QFT that we would like to study? And we will see in examples that this idea can be made precise and computable in interesting ways. And a brief reminder, this is something that has already been discussed, for instance, in Justin's talk and also by Iñaki. Why should we care about the symmetry field theory? Well, in my mind, it's a very interesting and useful object because it takes care of two very important physical properties of the system we want to consider. On the one hand, it knows about its Toft anomalies. If you wish, that's the invertible part of the symmetry field theory. But the symmetry field theory, we know, doesn't have to be an invertible theory. And indeed, when that's not the case, the symmetry field theory is encoding for us possible choices of global structure, by which very generally here I mean quantum field theories that share the same spectrum of local operators, but might differ in their spectra of extended objects. And Iñaki has covered part of the choice of global structures. So today I would like to focus more on the side related to the Toft anomalies. And as I mentioned, this is a very rich program, and I think there is lots of interesting things to discuss, as I have been interested in this for a few years, and of course also many people in the audience have thought about these questions. And I think something that we should strive to do is, on the one hand, trying to develop tools that are flexible. And since we know there are many interesting string reconstructions, I say in M theory, in type 2B, in F theory, I think we should try to cover as many of those as possible. And also trying to develop and to use in efficient ways tools that are finer and finer so that this supergravity or semi-classical analysis, if you wish, can tell us subtler and subtler aspects of generalized global symmetries, which are important because they might encode, say, dynamical implications that we want to uncover. And of course, there is so much to say about this that I won't be able to cover everything, but in order to sort of illustrate the power of this approach, I would like to discuss some aspects of two concrete examples. One will be about brains construction, and I would be focusing on M5 brains for concreteness. And then in the second part, I'll switch to a case where there are no brains, and it's actually a very close cousin of what Iñaki has told us about. It's gonna be M theory on a Calabi-Yau threefold singularity. So this was a broad introduction and motivation for the sort of questions I would like to discuss. And as I mentioned, the rest of the talk will be essentially structured in two main parts, the brain part and the geometry part, and then there will be some concluding remarks. So if there are no general questions about the motivation or the introduction, we can proceed with a more detailed description of the first part of the story, what happens if we have brains. And first, there are a few general remarks that we can make without committing to a specific string theory or M theory or a specific brain. And namely, we expect that there is a very well-known and established physical mechanism, anomaly inflow, that can be leveraged to learn about symmetries and anomalies of the QFT we want to study. And here, the main point to keep in mind is that while we want to study global symmetries of the QFT that lives on the word volume of our brain, these are actually corresponding to gauge symmetries in the full ambient space string theory or supergravity at low energies. And in a nutshell, the anomaly inflow mechanism stems from the fact that once we insert the brain in the ambient supergravity space, the effective action of the supergravity is no longer gauge invariant, which would be bad because, of course, we don't want anomalies in gauge symmetries. That would be an inconsistency. But the whole point of anomaly inflow is that this failure of gauge invariance in the ambient supergravity effective action is precisely canceled by the Toft anomalies of the global symmetries that live on the word volume of the brain. So these are the quantities we want to study, and the word volume of the brain might support quantum degrees of freedom that are really hard to study with other more conventional techniques. Inflow allows us to tackle the problem in a semi-classical computation in supergravity, and that's what makes it particularly useful and interesting. So those are very general remarks that would apply to brains in very different situations. And yet I told you that I would like to tell you something more about M5 brains in particular. So one might ask what's so nice about M5 brains? And of course it's also, there are, I guess, different ways of answering that question, but I guess in my mind, they really seem to be an excellent playground to develop and to apply these sort of tools based on anomaly inflow that we are after. And why is that the case? Well, on the one hand, M5 brains can really give us very interesting quantum field theories. Well, even the simplest thing you can do with M5s, just stack them on top of each other in flat space-time, already engineers for you a highly non-trivial superconformal theory in six dimension, which is still quite mysterious. And not only that, we can do more, and here I'm just mentioning another example. For instance, you can consider a stack of these objects still in six dimensions, non-compact dimensions, but put them on top of a singularity in space-time. If you wish, this is a little bit of a hybrid. It's an illustration that in string theory you can do both brains and singular geometries at once, and there is actually a very interesting interplay. In this specific example, what one obtains is a different kind of superconformal field theory that has less supersymmetry, and in a sense it has different features compared to the 2-0 theory. And as I mentioned in the introduction, it's great to have these non-trivial fixed points in higher dimensions, and it's even more fun to go down to then lower dimensions. And in terms of M5s, I'm referring to the idea of wrapping the M5 brain word volume on a compact space. And in order to retain control, we would like to preserve some of the supersymmetry of the parent six-dimensional theory, and we do that with a partial topological twist. And here, again, the prototypical example I have in my mind is the 6D to 4D story, which is indeed the famous class S program, which would be the 2-0 theory for 4D n equals 2, but we can do more. We can choose either a 2-0 starting point or 1-0 starting point, and then, for instance, try and construct interesting n equals 1 models in four dimensions. So this is just a sort of overview to try and convince you that you can really get very interesting QFTs from M5 brains. But that's only part of the story. We would like to do an efficient anomaly inflow computation. And now I would like to convince you that M5 brains are really great for that part too. And in particular, let's go back for a moment to the basics. How do M5 brains look like from the point of view of the ambient space? Well, they look like sources that are localized in a transverse R5, and therefore they are linked by a force sphere, and they are magnetically charged under the three-form gauge field of 11-dimensional supergravity. This is something I think that was also in Iñaki's talk. You can measure the number of brains by measuring the flux of G4. And then the other ingredient are the topological couplings that we have in the low energy effective action for M theory. And I have written them here. There is the first coupling, the CGG Chern-Simons term, is very well known. It's actually completely fixed by supersymmetry. And then there is a very special higher derivative correction constructed with this object I'm calling X8. It's a combination of the Pointragian classes of the tangent bundle of space-time, which is actually needed at the semi-classical level to make sense of the path integral of this 11-dimensional supergravity theory. So we should really include it, even though it's a higher derivative correction. And essentially now the challenge we are faced is what happens if we try to make sense of these ingredients at both? We want to have an M5 brain in space-time, which is a magnetic source for G4, and we need to make sense of these topological couplings that involve the C3 cage field. This is a subtle point that requires a careful treatment, and it was indeed analyzed in these seminal papers, where it was realized that indeed there is an anomaly inflow. There is a failure of gauge invariance due to the magnetic source that implies indeed that these topological couplings are not quite gauge invariant in the background, in the presence of M5 brains. But of course that's good news, because if we compute this failure at a semi-classical level, we can access anomalies of quantum degrees of freedom that are difficult to study otherwise. So this is an old story, and what I have been working on with my collaborators is turning these ideas into systematic tools that we can apply to different setups to compute anomalies in an efficient way. And while M5 brains in six dimensions are already interesting, they, as I mentioned, they become even more interesting once you reduce them. So once you wrap them on some compact space. And let's say, at least in a first approximation, that we would like to learn something about the continuous part of the global symmetries. That makes it a little easier from a technical point of view, because it means that we can use the language of differential forms. And in particular, we know that when we're dealing with continuous symmetries, there is a very efficient tool to describe the anomalies, the anomaly polynomial, and therefore that's the object that we would like to access, the anomaly polynomial of the word volume QFT that lives on our brains, on the non-compact part. And what the inflow paradigm tells us is that in order to access this quantity, we have to compute the inflow anomaly polynomial, which is just the name I'm giving to the phenomenon I described earlier, the failure of gauge invariance of the topological couplings in 11-dimensional supergravity. And therefore, our task is precisely to compute this object and try and do it in a variety of situations and in systematic ways. So what the derivation is a little lengthy and maybe not necessarily something you are interested in, but I would like at least to highlight the main steps in the construction. So I would like to guide you from the input data to the output, which is the inflow anomaly polynomial, describing at least some of the key steps along the way. So what is the input data? As I alluded to in the introduction, is going to be topological and geometrical. And in this case, it's exactly this internal space L, which is a compact space that is essentially describing for us the angular directions that are not the external space-time directions. And this is only part of the story, though. We also need to know what background flux is threading this internal space. And here, I will be modeling that thinking in terms of forms. So I'm going to need a closed form with integral periods where the integrality follows from the flux quantization. And maybe this sounds a little abstract. So I would like to illustrate it in two simple examples. The first example, in a sense, it's almost a known example. It's a rephrasing of the picture we had a few slides back. If we want to consider non-wrapped brains in space-time, the object I'm calling L is literally the force sphere that surrounds them in their transverse directions. And the background flux G bar 4 that threads it, it's simply the volume form suitably normalized with a factor of N actually that's missing to count how many brains we have. But then we can do something more interesting. We can wrap the brains, say, on a smooth genus G Riemann surface sigma. And in that case, what you find for this internal space is going to be an S4 bundle over sigma G. And there is also a G4 bar flux that essentially corresponds to the fiber, the S4 fiber. And you might wonder, why is it not a direct product? Why is it not S4 times sigma G? And essentially the reason is that we need some non-trivial vibration to preserve some of the supersymmetry. As a side comment, the mechanism of anomaly inflow per se does not require supersymmetry, but it's still desirable to have it to keep control over the setup and make sure that what we're doing is reliable. And so this is the sort of input data I have in mind. It's in a compact, smooth internal space supported by some G4 flux configuration. And now we're left with the main task to perform the anomaly inflow computation. Namely, we have to find a way of going from the background flux, which is just part of our input, to the full G4. And what do I mean by full G4? To see that, let's step back a moment. What we would like to do is describe a a Toft anomaly for a global symmetry in a QFT. And we know that to do that, we have to include a background field for that global symmetry. And those correspond to gauge fields in this supergravity effective action that we get reducing on the space L. So what we have to do, in other words, is look for possible sources of gauge fields in our supergravity. And in order to do that, we can borrow intuition familiar from the field of Kaluza-Klein reductions and identify, among others, two sources for gauge fields. The first is isometries of the internal space. This is literally the hallmark of the Kaluza-Klein recipe. And in that these gauge fields, which we think of them as essentially off-diagonal components of the total space metric. And these are ordinary, that's the type, zero-form, they correspond to zero-form symmetries and they themselves are one-form gauge fields. And of course, they can be non-abelian. But then there is another class of gauge fields that we know we can get in supergravity in a variety of situations. And namely, we can have non-trivial cohomology classes in our internal space. And the KK recipe tells us that when that happens, what we can do is take our three-form gauge fields in M theory and consider fluctuations that have this form. They are an external gauge field. Here, I'm denoting it A3 minus P. And internally, there is a harmonic P form. And here, the as you can see, since P could be a priori a few different values, we have access to higher form symmetries. We can go beyond zero form. And here, the fact that the form is harmonic per se is not super important. The important part is that it's a non-trivial cohomology class that is non-torsional and also integrally quantized. So these are the sort of background fields or slash gauge field in supergravity that we have to turn on. And therefore, now our task is how do we turn on these fields and therefore turn our background G4 flux into the full G4 configuration that we can use for inflow. And essentially, we can think about this step in several sub-steps. So the first, the easier one in a sense, is to first take care of the cohomological part. This is essentially the same equation I wrote before. Before I told you that I was expanding C3 onto harmonic forms, I can just expand the G4 field strength and it's the same thing. But that's of course only half of the story. We have the isometries in the game. And geometrically activating a Kaluza-Klein vector from an isometry corresponds to fibering our internal space over external spacetime. And in this fibration, the connection is identified with the KK vectors. So I'm going to think of the base of this fibration. I'm calling it W. It's essentially spacetime, but I'm thinking about it in a sort of weak rotated way and also extending it to higher dimensions because that's where the anomaly polynomial is going to live, at least formally. And now, though, we're faced with a technical challenge. We have these two ingredients, but they have to be combined in a coherent way. And that's where the third and final step comes in. If you wish, if we didn't have this vibration at step two, we would have just a bunch of forms of cohomology classes in the internal space L, and those would be perfectly okay. But now we have a total space, and it's not guaranteed that these forms are going to be globally well-defined. And indeed, in general, they are not. But there is a way out, and namely, we can promote them to their G-equivariant completions, which is just a way of saying that, indeed, you have to consider the action of the isometry group and therefore construct globally defined objects that are simultaneously gauge-invariant and closed in physics language. Now, this step might sound maybe a little esoteric or mysterious, and therefore, I would like to sort of demystify it with a simple toy example. It's not directly relevant per se for M5s, but I think it might be useful in so that you can understand a little better what I mean by this equivariant completion. So let's pretend that our internal space is just a two-sphere, a round two-sphere, with its familiar metric and volume form. And let's consider a U1 subgroup of its isometries, the one that it's realized by the phi angle in this presentation. What we can imagine doing is saying, okay, let's take this S2 fiber and fiber it over some base space, turning on a connection for this U1 phi isometry. And in a local description, we know what to do. We have to couple the angular differential to a gauge field and perform this replacement everywhere. But of course, we are now in trouble in that the new candidate omega 2 form is no longer closed. However, there is an easy way of fixing it. We fix it by adding a term which is proportional to the field strength of our gauge field A. And as you can see, at the end, we do get an object which is both closed and gauge invariant and can be indeed identified with the desired equivariant completion. Now, this is a very sort of physicist way of doing it, thinking about a gauging and restoring closure. But at the end, what we are seeing here is essentially a polyform. There is the two-form part and a zero-form part, this cosine factor. And what I'm describing here in physics language is actually the very same as the Cartan model for equivariant cohomology, at least with real coefficients, so that we can use differential forms. So I hope this was useful in sort of demystifying this step, which might sound a little scary at first. Okay, so now we have identified what kind of input data we want. We have done sort of the heavy lifting, going from G4 bar to G4, the full G4. And now we're almost done. The final steps in the computation are to construct a 12 form that I'm calling I12. And it's written here, and it probably looks familiar. It's just an avatar of the topological couplings in M theory. Essentially, you take the CGG and CX8, you hit it with a D, and you get this object. But of course, we have to keep in mind, now G4 contains a whole plethora of background fields. That's the interesting part. And then we also have to compute X8. And we have to keep in mind in this computation also that we have now external gauge fields. And the final step is this integral on the internal space, which is essentially a fiber integration. And here, by fiber, I'm referring to this vibration on point 2, that L is fibered over our base space. Okay, so at the end, this, depending on the, it could be a very easy computation, it could be slightly more cumbersome computation, but it's very well defined, and it can be applied to several different situations. It might be though, yes, so I might have maybe given the impression that you go through this geometric computation and you're done, like you have the anomalies of the QFT you want to study. And there is, though, a very important caveat that I have to mention because it's physically important, and namely that it's true. Inflow is a very exact statement that relates the inflow anomaly polynomial to the total anomalies that live on the word volume of our brains. But the problem is that, essentially, in all interesting situations, that word volume theory at low energies consists of a piece which is interesting for us, for instance, a superconformal field theory, and a piece that is considerably less interesting, a bunch of free fields. But those do have anomalies, and therefore, if we want to extract the anomalies of the part we want, we have to keep them into account. And this is a phenomenon that we see already in the prototypical example, brains that are not wrapped or anything, because indeed, in that case, I mentioned that you get this interesting 6D to 0 CFT. But you also get a free tensor multiplet, whose anomalies are perfectly known, but have to be appropriately subtracted to get the correct result. And I would say, from the experience that in various cases we have studied, this seems to be a general pattern. The modes that decouple from the inflow analysis tend to be always associated to the overall center of mass mode of our stack of brains. So that's to say that it's presumably a tractable problem because it's always essentially related to this free tensor multiplet or suitable variation thereof. Okay, So this was a lot of formalism. I hope I didn't completely scare you away. What's the physics behind it? What can we actually do with all this technology? And I think we can do a lot of interesting things. And I really, of course, because of time, I won't have the chance of sort of giving you details about these various applications, but I would like to say a few words about some of them, because I think it helps illustrate the sort of problems and physical questions that we can address using this sort of formalism. One of the things we can do is consider not just the CFT on a smooth Riemann surface, but consider punctures. Then I think I'll say briefly a few words about what connections to holography. And another thing that we have been studying recently is use this technology to learn something about very subtle decoupling phenomena that sometimes occur in renormalization group flows, which at this stage probably sounds a little abstract, but I will give you a concrete example by what I mean and what kind of questions it involves. A few words about punctures. And, I don't really have the time to sort of review what we mean exactly by inserting a puncture on a Riemann surface in this sort of constructions, but I can give you a more geometric intuition of what's going on. We have seen before that if we take our CFT on a smooth Riemann surface, the input data, this compact space L that we should consider, is an S4 bundle over the Riemann surface in question. And essentially, the key effect of introducing punctures from this geometrical point of view is to modify this. And if we puncture our Riemann surface, it means that the space L6 we should consider is no longer everywhere an S4 bundle, but has a richer topology, a richer structure. And what we were able to identify in this paper with Ibu, Emily, and Ruben was a recipe to get a handle over what L6 should be. And the idea essentially is to consider the punctures on the Riemann surface and remove little disks around them, and in the process also removing the S4 on top. So we are left with sort of holes in our 6D space, and now the task is to fill them in with something more interesting than just S4 over something two-dimensional. Something I'm denoting schematically here by big X. We call it a local puncture geometry. Its details are not terribly important for today, but there is one point that I would like to emphasize, and namely that these local puncture geometries admit very non-trivial force cycles. So that's interesting because it means that the background G4 bar can have a more refined structure, and indeed it does. There is more data to it than just the total number of brains, to the point actually that we were able to see the emergence in geometry of the partition of N that is well known to be a way of labeling regular punctures in for D(n) equals 2 plus S. So we see it in the geometry, which I think is quite interesting. And now, once we have this input, we can run the whole machinery I have described. And why is it interesting? Well, one way I think is interesting is because it gives you essentially a first principle derivation of what these punctures are doing to the Toft anomalies of your 4D theory. Now, this is something that was already known independently by other more indirect field theory arguments, but there is one point I would like to stress. This is something you cannot really see in an obvious way doing anomaly reduction just from 6D to 4D. In other words, the 6D parent theory has an anomaly polynomial and you can integrate it in a meaningful way on the surface. But this fails to capture the contributions of these punctures. And to do that, we really have to go back all the way to 11 dimensions, to the M-theory setup with brains, and then we can do it. We can do it and give a first principle description. What I find also interesting is that we can actually apply the same ideas not only to regular punctures, but also to some class of irregular punctures, which on the field theory side are interesting because they can give us a family of four-dimensional theories known as those of Argyris-Douglas type that have really striking features that singles them out in the landscape of 4D theories. So objects of particular interest for physicists. And in this instance, for example, the input data we need to run our computation can be read off from holography, because in collaboration with Imu, Emily, and Ruben, we have made a proposal for what the dual of some of these Argyris-Douglas theory might be. And using that proposed dual, we can use the internal space to read off the data and run the anomaly inflow computation. Now, I should, yes, please.
Is this just a technical issue, or is this really that in the puncture there is not the information that you need, and you have to go to the full supergravity?
I think it's, for us it was, I guess, mostly a matter of convenience, but I do believe that there should be a way. In a sense, one of the most interesting things that I would like to understand better in this problem is precisely how to establish a map between the Hitchin description and the geometry. And I do believe that should be possible, and it should cover both regular and irregular punctures. But sort of like computationally, we found it convenient to use the supergravity description. I should be honest, as a sort of caveat, these are singular supergravity solutions, so maybe you might feel a little uncomfortable using them to compute physical observables, but yet what we observe is that we can extract physical quantities, and they match nicely with known properties of the field theory. And in relation to what I'm talking about today, these inflow methods, I believe, are extremely efficient, for instance, to probe the central charges of the theory. And in particular, I think the flavor central charges, which would be a little more cumbersome to attack using more holographic techniques. And finally, a few words about this other application, which is also in the realm, essentially, of what can we say about a 4D theory that comes from 6D, if we go all the way back to 11 dimensions. Like, can we learn something new? And to illustrate this idea, let me consider a concrete example. It might sound a little ad hoc and maybe something you're not directly super interested in, but for us it was nice, because it showcases interesting features that I think might also show up in other contexts. So let's be concrete and pick a parent theory in 6D to go down. And I will be picking this guy I mentioned earlier. You can take a stack of brains and put them on top of a C2 mod ZK singularity. And that engineers a 6D10 CFT for you. And now we can go down to 4 dimensions. This is a very rich program. It's one of the generalizations of the Class S program that has been studied extensively in the literature. From our point of view, we should think about essentially a tail of two anomalies, if you wish. Like, we are interested in going down to 4D. The central object of interest is the 4D n equal 1 CFT. Now, if you are more field theory inclined, you would say, okay, I'm doing a field theory analysis from 6 dimensions. I know the anomaly of the 6D theory. I integrate them down the Riemann surface, and I get an answer. But now we have an alternative way. We can go all the way back to 11 dimensions and consider the M5 brain setup that is realizing this kind of 4-dimensional theories. And we can do the computation there using the inflow tools that I have described. And actually, we can learn a lot by comparing the two sides, because the comparison turns out to be non-trivial. And one of the key points is that on both sides, there is some sort of splitting of decoupling modes that's happening. On the inflow side is the thing I mentioned earlier briefly, that there are center of mass modes, and those get sort of decoupled in the AR. We have to subtract them. But what happens on the field theory side, in a sense, is much wilder. We observe a whole collection of four-dimensional decoupling fields that admits quite intricate pattern of charges and degeneracies that are quite, they would be a little hard to study directly in field theory. But by comparing these two sites, we have predictions for what these should be for general values of the parameters of the problem. So the Riemann surface, for instance, could have arbitrary genus. If it's a torus, there are Lagrangian techniques available to check in very great detail all these claims about the various decoupling patterns. But what I find interesting is that this more geometric point of view gives us predictions that should apply beyond the cases that we can analyze using Lagrangian theories. So I believe this to be an example of this synergy between geometric techniques and field theoretic Lagrangian techniques that could actually tell us important lessons in various contexts. Okay, so that was the last application related to the more brain side of the story. And in the rest of the talk, I would like to switch gears and tell you something about the other side of the story. We have no brains, just singular geometry. So this could be a good time for questions, or otherwise we can proceed and have questions later. Okay. So essentially what I have discussed is we have leveraged anomaly inflow, this physical mechanism that is very well known and understood, to have these systematic tools to approach quantum field theories realized with brains. And I would like just to mention that actually similar techniques can also be applied, for instance, to D3 brains. That's something that we were able to achieve. So this all seems very promising, and I think it really hints to the fact that this should be something general that goes beyond the standard anomaly inflow paradigm. Because of course, if we now change gears and say, okay, there are no brains, there is just a singular singularity in space-time, at least to me, it's not entirely obvious that there is a standard anomaly inflow at play. And yet, what we see that is possible and computable in very concrete ways is that we can apply the same philosophy. Consider the supergravity description of the ambient space in which the singularity lives, and use those to compute properties of the global symmetries of the QFTs realized in the singularity. That's an idea, of course, that has already appeared in Iñaki's talk. So what I'm going to discuss now is going to be a complementary sort of discussion of some aspects that weren't covered in that talk. Just for concreteness, let me state precisely what sort of geometries we have considered. We have worked in M-theory, and we have considered reductions down to five-dimensional non-compact directions of space-time. So our internal space is six-dimensional, and it's depicted here as a cone, because it is indeed a real cone over a five-dimensional space, which has to be a Sasaki-Einstein manifold so that the total space has restricted holonomy and we preserve supersymmetry. And I would like to mention one example that for us was like very nice because it helps us guide our computations, namely a famous example of a Sasaki-Einstein 5 manifold, at least in the physics community, the YPQs. And it turns out that if you choose that as your space, so if your non-compact Calabi-Yau is a cone over YPQ, you are realizing a five-dimensional SCFT, which can be mass deformed to five-dimensional super-Young-Mills theory with gauge group SUP and a Chern-Simons level Q. So you see how the geometry determines the gauge theory data. And from this gauge theory description, there are two global symmetries that we can read off in an easy way. One of them is a zero form symmetry, is the instanton form symmetry that we have in general in non-abelian gauge theories in five dimensions. Its background field is a usual gauge field. It's a continuous object and locally it's a one form. But then there is also a one form symmetry, which roughly speaking is the center symmetry of this gauge theory, except that it's modified by the presence of the Chern-Simons level. The details are not super important, but the take home message is that this is a one form symmetry, so a higher symmetry, and it's discrete. So its background field is not a form in the usual sense, it's rather a cohomology class of degree two with coefficients in a cyclic group which is whose order is the order of the one-form symmetry. And now what can be done in field theory, which has been analyzed by these authors, is to compute Toft anomalies for these global symmetries. And those are encoded in a six-dimensional topological theory that contains, among other things, these two couplings. So these are cubic couplings. One of them is purely discrete, is B2 repeated three times. This is an anomaly, cubic anomaly for the one-form symmetry. And then there is a mixed anomaly between a zero-form symmetry, the instanton one, a continuous one, and the discrete one-form symmetry. And here, these alpha 1, alpha 2 are the anomaly, the Toft anomaly coefficients, which in this instance are valued in R mod Z. So what we have to do is compute, or we would like to do, is to compute these coefficients, alpha 1 and alpha 2, in a geometric way, using the sort of ideas that have proven successful when we have brains. Now, how are we supposed to do this? Well, the general philosophy has already appeared in Iñaki's talk, and I believe also in Sagar's gong show and her poster. And it's the idea that we should start from the topological couplings in supergravity and reduce them. And morally speaking, we can think of this as deforming the cone to a cigar and then this sort of half line, which at least heuristically is motivated by the fact that we're interested in topological qualities that should not depend on this sort of deformations. And here again, we have our starting point, the topological couplings in M theory, just like we had in the previous case. And we have an idea of what we should do. We should do a KK reduction on the link space. So it's a well-defined problem. We have 11-dimensional supergravity on a 5D Sasaki-Einstein space, YPQ for concreteness. But so in principle, it seems quite straightforward, but there is a key point that we have to keep in mind. One of the ingredients we want to capture is the one-form symmetry, which is discrete. It's really crucial. If we don't have that, there is not much physics to discuss in this instance. But that originates from torsional cycles in our internal space, in the Sasaki-Einstein L5. So in other words, we are faced with a technical challenge which could be phrased as, how do we do a Kaluza-Klein expansion onto a torsional cycle in our internal space? That's something that is outside the scope of the usual techniques based on a local description with differential forms. So we have to do something slightly different. And even though one could use forms to capture some aspects of torsion, which has been explored in the literature, we found it more convenient to use differential cohomology. And because that is really well suited to precisely describe torsional phenomena that are of the sort we would like to study. And here, a very brief caveat, what we have considered is the differential refinement of ordinary cohomology with Z coefficients. And for us, it was enough to capture important physics. But we know already that's not going to be the full answer. For instance, we know that in type two string theory, we should consider a K theory, and therefore its differential refinement. And there is going to be some suitable cohomology theory in M theory, and we should consider the differential refinement of that. But since not much is known, and of course quite challenging, we just stick to this. And then we can go ahead and compute. And the details are not super important, but I would like to flash a few ingredients. The first is the starting point. It's probably familiar. We have seen it now in a few incarnations, it's again the object that encodes the topological couplings in M theory, but now we think about it as a class in differential cohomology, which I'm denoting here with these little hats on the various forms. But as you can see, the formal structure is very similar, and the formal manipulations you can do with it are also very similar, to the point that running the KK machinery, we get to this prediction for what the anomaly coefficients should be. So the first line is something we have seen. It's the general structure of the Toft anomalies. The unknowns are the alpha coefficients. And now, using differential geometry, we have a geometric expression for those. We have to take these objects I'm calling T and V, which I haven't really introduced in any detail, but suffices to say they are cohomology classes that capture both torsional as well as non-torsional cycles in the geometry in a very democratic and efficient way, and combine them in this non-trivial way, which is essentially a refinement of the torsion pairing, which is the natural pairing that you should consider when you have torsional cycles. So now at least we have a very precise formulation of the problem we have to tackle. We are given a geometry, L5, for instance, YPQ. We are given some differential cohomology classes on this geometry, and we have to compute these linking pairings. And let me emphasize, this is a problem that is purely defined in this 5D space. It might be very hard, but it's geometric computation. How do we actually go ahead and do it?
There's a question from sure. Greg Moore. What is the evidence that you should use a cohomology theory other than H sub Z in M theory?
I believe one way to argue for that is to leverage several string theory, M theory dualities that are going to presumably indicate that the framework of ordinary cohomology in M theory will not be sufficient to say reproduce the known need for K theory, say in type 2A going down on a circle. At least as a first possible answer, I would think of that. And presumably also more refined dualities to type 2B.
He says on the contrary.
Okay, well, that's
there is amazing agreement. Okay, maybe Greg, we will postpone this to after the talk because we're almost finished.
No, that sounds
good. K-theory is in type 2, he's absolutely right about that.
Okay, well, no, thank you for the remark. It's a point that I would definitely like to understand better. And now very briefly, I would just like to flash the main computational tool that we use to tackle this, the computation of these linking pairings. And namely, we can map this computation that has to do with torsional phenomena in a 5D compact space to a more traditional intersection theory of non-torsional cycles in a non-compact space. And that space is precisely the Calabi-Yau cone over the YPQ, or rather, a suitable resolution. And here, I just wanted to flash that this example happens to be toric, which makes the computation very amenable to combinatorial techniques. At the end of the day, you do get very concrete numbers, and they agree with the field theory predictions. But now that we have confidence in our methods, we can also apply them to situations in which there is no non-abelian gauge theory description. And here, I'm just flashing two toric diagrams that are just there to represent two examples of a whole bunch of models that are known to exist and being no Lagrangian, for which one can compute similar Tolft anomalies using very same techniques. So in conclusion, I hope I convinced you that there is a systematic way of handling the anomalies and the global symmetries of quantum field theories that we realized in string theory, both when we have brains and well as when we have a singular geometry. And even though the technical details look a little different in the various cases, there is a remarkable agreement about what the main physics is going on. We have essentially a reduction of the supergravity couplings we see in the parent theory on the compact space that surrounds the singularity. And I have described a couple of examples in which this idea, which is a little abstract, is actually made very concrete and computational. Of course, there are several interesting directions. I have considered specific examples because those are more amenable to computations, but of course there is a whole zoo of different interesting geometric engineering setups that I'd like to understand better. One might ask, what about combining the two parts of the talk? One part was about brains and the other about torsion. And indeed, there are interesting examples that I've been thinking about with my collaborators that combine these two ingredients. And also other, in a similar direction, at some point there was a focus on isometries and being equivariant. And then in the second part of the talk, there was a focus on more being a differential refinement to capture torsion. These two should be combined and can be combined indeed. in a covariant differential cohomology. So for a physicist, the challenge is to find efficient ways of using these tools to uncover new physical phenomena. And I think more generally, the biggest challenge is to really find more and more refined ways of thinking about the supergravity fields to capture more and more subtle aspects of global symmetries. And here, of course, the non-invertibles are one of the main goals that I would really like to understand better. And of course, also many people in the audience would like that too. And with that, I will thank you.
Thanks very much for this nice talk. Other questions?
Sorry, on this last point, do you think that this mathematical framework is suitable to like see non-invertible symmetries from the geometry, or do you think that there should be another mathematical framework? Because it seems hard to me to like encode the structure of non-invertible symmetries in geometry. So what do you think?
Well, I think it's probably hard to give a general answer because we know that there are many ways of getting non-invertibles in field theory and with sort of different degrees of sophistication. I think one point that it's probably an easier entry point is the situation in which we know that the non-invertibles are related by gauging to, say, a mixed anomaly. So what I believe definitely to be possible there is to essentially leverage the mixed anomaly frame, and then the missing part would be to understand what does it mean in string theory to choose to gauge or not to gauge, and then go to the non-invertible frame. This would be a first way. In a sense, one might wonder, what about what Justin was referring to as intrinsically non-invertible situations? And indeed, those seem more challenging, but I also have hope that we can make sense of those.
A more basic question. So I, if I understand correctly, with this framework, you get essentially flavor anomalies, no? And diffeomorphism anomalies, discrete and continuous. But do you get also anomalies like between time reversal and stuff, like these kind of more subtle things, or it's hard, like parity, things that are discrete in space-time in some sense?
But can you repeat the example you have in mind? I couldn't quite hear.
I don't know, like these kind of anomalies between time reversal and one-form symmetries,
yes.
Have some space-time component, but some flavor component.
That's right. No, I think indeed it should be possible. And I think in my mind, in a sense, it has to do with the level of precision and detail at which we describe the fields in the supergravity. Because, we have a metric, and in principle, it's all there. It's all about the space-time topology. So the challenge, I think, is to develop tools that allows us to extract this more subtle background fields that we need to capture those anomalies from the ingredients that we do have in the supergravity description, namely the metric and the various gauge fields.
Okay.
Any other questions? No? So, Greg, can he unmute himself? I actually don't know. Okay, maybe that's too complicated. We can have maybe a discussion later. Yes. Oh, excellent. Perfect. Yes. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I just wanted to remark that there's actually fairly non-trivial evidence that you should use ordinary singular homology as the generalized cohomology theory in M theory, and that it's compatible with K theory. And that's a computation I did with Emmanuel Diaconescu and Edward Witten around 2000. So making some restrictions on the flux so that it holds for circle bundles over 10 manifolds. So what we did is we studied the theta function that you get from sum over fluxes on a compact 11 manifold. For the C field in M theory and compared it with the theta function that you would get on a 10 manifold associated with K theory. And the crucial aspect in formulating these theta functions is the choice of a quadratic refinement. And so we considered the case where the 11 manifold is a circle bundle over a 10 manifold. And we restricted ourselves, although you don't have to, unpublished work shows you don't have to, but we restricted ourselves to the case where the push forward of the flux is just torsion. In other words, the H flux in the type two theory is torsion. Anyway, there's a quadratic refinement that's used in, well, the M theory, Chern-Simons term, reduces to a certain quadratic refinement on the degree four cohomology. That's when you use singular cohomology as the basis for formulating the C field. And on the other hand, the Ramon-Ramon fields, as you said, are thought to be classified by K-theory. And so there's a totally different quadratic refinement that you use in K-theory. And the two agree, and therefore the theta functions agree. And that's non-trivial. And the way that happens is that in the M-theory case, the quadratic refinement, because of some amazing connections to between this C field and E8 gauge theory, the quadratic refinement can be thought of in terms of a mod 2 index for Dirac operator coupled to an E8 gauge field. And then when you have the circle bundle kind of story, you can relate that to the natural quadratic refinement you'd use in K theory. So I've always regarded that as a surprising example of the compatibility of the generalized cohomology theory being singular homology in N theory and K theory in type 2A, at least in the case where the space-time is has a geometrical description and the coupling is weak. The flying on the ointment there is incorporating S-duality. But that's a very long and complicated discussion. And it's not quite clear that you should really try and incorporate S-duality within the framework of just supergravity, which is a priori only valid at large distance scales and weak curvatures. End of message.
Okay, thanks. Do you want to comment? No? Okay. Let's thank Federico and...